And you're very welcome back to the Greg Hughes Podcast. My guest this week is a global heavy hitter in medicine, but he started out in County Donegal. He's a clinical academic, a top NHS consultant, and recently made history as the first person from the Republic of Ireland to be awarded the prestigious Hebbardine Medal for his groundbreaking work in rheumatology. Professor Dennis McGonigal has spent over 30 years at the forefront of understanding how the immune system triggers arthritis, a career that has seen treatments evolve from simple steroid injections to life-saving modern drugs. But today we're stepping outside the lab. We're talking about his school days in Carndonagh, where he freely admits he was a bit of a smartass, and his deep roots back home in County Donegal. This is a brilliant, wide-ranging and at times emotional chat. We cover everything from the brutal reality of autoimmune diseases and his warning against cowboy private clinics to a fascinating link between human arthritis treatments and local alpacas. Plus, we managed to dive into everything from gout to how space travel impacts the human body. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome onto the podcast Professor Dennis McGonigal. Okay, my guest on the podcast this week, I'm delighted to say, is a former guest of the radio program. That's Professor Dennis McGonigal. Dennis, a very good day to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Greg, and thank you for asking me to join you.
You're speaking to us as a professional, a professor at the University of Leeds, but your story obviously starts in County Donegal, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. I'm from Ballynahona and Glengad and Mallon and North Innishowen. Yep.
And your early memories of that part of the world, Glengad?
The earliest thing I can recall, and I had to check with my mother, was when the ESB came and put in a pole outside my grandmother's house, which was apparently a thing called electricity. And she said I was about 2.5 at the time. So I've witnessed a technological transformation in North Innishowen. My uncles had a horse, and our neighbour also had a Clydesdale horse, and there's a few tractors and cars around. So yeah, I've crossed two millennia.
Indeed, it sounds like you're ancient, talking of electrification, but maybe it was just very late into North Innishowen, is that it?
I suspect that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Were you very academic? Were you clever? Were you a clever child?
Well, when I went to school, I seemed to have a great interest. That's what I remember. I had a great interest in learning. Or as the old Irish phrase says, cicrus conolus, greed for knowledge. So I've always been very motivated to learn. And that's one of the things I tell people. I say I've been at school for 56 years, because as a professor, I spend a lot of my time reading and trying to keep up to date. So yeah, that's been a lifelong thing, learning. Yeah.
Yeah, I prefer your way of saying it. People often say every day is a learning day, but I like your phraseology a little bit better, I think. I imagine you were very inquisitive in school, always asking the teachers questions, were you?
Yeah, I asked lots of questions. I used to get put at the front of the class when the inspector came round. And one day he came round and he asked, is the top of Everest closer to the sun than the ground? And we said, yes. And then he said, why is the top of Everest covered in snow? And we were all dumbfounded. And the teacher was trying to tell me, you know, it's because you know, the flat ground radiates heat back and it warms it up. And there's not enough there at the top of the mountain. And I couldn't hear the teacher. So, yeah, sometimes it didn't work.
My dad was born in 1940, and he always tells this story, and I'm not quite true. I'm not sure how true it is or not, but someone came in, a professor of some sort or other, came in the late 40s and was taking questions. And one of the questions was from one of the students, will man ever be on the moon? And apparently this academic replied, no, you could never build a ladder high enough. I'm not sure if that is true or not, but anyway, it's an old tale that's stuck the test of time.
I came to awareness just after the moon landing, and obviously people were talking about a Mars landing before 1980. So Things have not moved on so much since the moon landing.
I know it's not necessarily your area of expertise, but do you think we'll ever see someone on Mars?
Actually, Greg's a very good question. I think the challenge is, we're hardwired to live on Earth, and if you send us up around the atmosphere for 2 months, they have to be lifted out of the pod because they completely lose your bone. You get osteoporosis, and if you stood up, your skeleton would collapse. A huge amount of medical science goes into getting somebody back to health after they come down from 3 months in orbit around the Earth. So the medical challenges alone are staggering. And despite Elon Musk's many achievements and Tesla and Starlink, etc., he's been right a few times, but this could be, medically impossible potentially would be my bet. But obviously, I won't be around to collect the money on that one.
I wonder what's happening, or you can tell us perhaps what's happening that it has such a negative impact on, the skeleton effectively and what supports it.
So basically, the cells that control our skeleton, they are completely dependent on the load which is provided by gravity and exercise. So, for example, a tennis player will have much stronger bone on a serving side, and people who do exercise, they build up their skeleton and muscle. So basically, it's an integral part of our health and physiology is normal loading. And not only that, we have a we actually people talk about our eyes have rods and cones which sense light. There's actually a third light sensor in the back of your eye, but it goes to the top of your brain, and it has nothing to do with sight. But what it does is it locks you into 24-hour cycles. So it's called a clock. It's called a clock gene. So we're hardwired to the 24-hour cycle, right down in the cells and molecules. And this is why we get jet lag, for example. So at so many levels, the human body is hardwired for the surface of this earth. It's
Wow, that's re
unbelievable.
remarkable. So that's almost like a sensor. Is that why maybe people who work night shifts, for an example, struggle because this is it's disrupting it.
Correct. And as I say, there's a light sensor in your eye that's not like you looking at me now, but it actually is connected to a nucleus or a little control center in the brain that regulates this day-night cycle and wakefulness, and then it goes from the brain to every organ in your body, and including like appetite. And then your weight can go off. There's all sorts of complexities. It's bewildering, and that's another reason going to Mars will be very, very difficult.
But just in relation to that, you talk about it being hardwired. Obviously, our days and nights vary in length, and then we have some parts of the world where you have very long days or very long nights, whichever way you wish to talk about it. Are we adaptive if exposed for prolonged periods of time, or is there something of a locked-in element to it?
There is. There certainly is adaptation, and you know yourself in the long evenings this time of year in North Donegal. People still, the sun's still out, still light at 10:45, or it used to be when I lived there. We still go to bed, but I think we do wake up earlier when, if you don't have curtain, if you don't pull the curtains, right? So yeah, it's nuanced, but you can adapt to some degree.
National school obviously went quite good for you, as it does many people. On to secondary school, Corran Donagh Community School. You weren't necessarily grade A student in behaviour, maybe academically or what have you. Even though you were clearly clever, secondary school can do that to us. What was that part of your education like?
I said before, particularly at national school, when I finished my work, I distracted others, which in hindsight I regret, being a bit of a smart aleck. But at secondary school, that didn't happen so much because we had a very able and intimidating 6'5" priest father, Father McKenna, and when I saw him a quarter of a mile away, I quickly made my way without any delays to the next class.
Okay.
So I was less disruptive. I wasn't so disruptive at secondary school, and then lunch times were taken up by football and cross country running. Yeah, it was a good experience. But I only knuckled down to study for the Leaving Cert. Before that, I was, playing sport and just getting by. Yeah.
But just in terms of your behavior in school, sometimes we play up, and I did a little bit myself, and it's to mask something else. I just wonder for you, was it that? Or perhaps maybe when you were getting your work done quicker, maybe things weren't moving as quickly academically as your brain was capable of, and you became a little bit bored or frustrated?
No, I think in hindsight, most of it has just been a typical, early teenagehood, being a, coming to awareness and potentially early adult, and trying to be one of the lads, and each trying to outdo each other in terms of trying to be comedic and, that sort of silliness. Yeah, we survived that. And as I was saying in the piece in the paper, I got to school, and then Pink Floyd's The Wall came, and that song, Another Brick in the Wall, was released, and saying, "Hey, teacher, leave those kids alone, and you're another brick in the wall." And as much as I enjoyed the melody, I knew in my heart that, this is not good. We need these teachers to get us through life when we're away from our parents. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And these structures have been established because they work,
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, and I'm a big proponent of of reasonable discipline. In our school, there was a there was a, the Father McKenna had a strap, so you get smacked in your hand if you misbehaved. And one day in the art class, somebody used a chemical doing something, or in the science class. And the chemical basically smelt like sulfur dioxide, which is produced by rotten eggs, which is also used in stink bombs. And it was washed down the sink, and it come up in the art class next door. And the kids were accused of letting off a stink bomb. And apparently Father McKenna turned up with a strap, and then nobody confessed to the crime, which wasn't committed. And some like 13-year-old kids were getting a few hard smacks in the hand. Yeah, generally speaking, I'm very pro good discipline, but that was the one exception to that going wrong in
I
our
mean, I
school.
would be of an age and of an attitude where I would hold myself back from saying, well, it didn't do us any harm. The truth is, at home, a little bit of extra punishment, it actually really didn't do us any harm, if the case may. But it's such, you can't speak in broad strokes because obviously it varies from child to child, and also the level of discipline varies greatly as well. And we've seen in our dark past as well, where you if you get a free rein in that regard, it's exploited.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the UK, and I don't know what it's like in Ireland, but the pendulum swung to the other extreme, where a parent could potentially, there's a danger that it could be
Oh no,
falls
I
foul of the
saw
law for discipline.
I remember a story going back a little bit, and maybe things have calmed down. Often we move very far forward, and then we sort of find our. But I think a mum or a dad was seen slapping a child's bum in a supermarket, and the police were arrived, and it was pursued down that line. But we don't hear too many cases of that, thankfully.
No, thankfully, yeah. Hope you're right. Yeah.
Secondary school, are you saying that you ticked along in Carrigdon Community School, but then really got your head into it for sort of the final leg? Is that how it went?
Yeah, the first 3 years I was playing football and also in the cross country team, and we actually came third in the national finals in Palaskenry in the national PE Centre 1981 or two. I used to run a lot with a very good team. And then playing football was a big interest, but then the inter-cert came and went, and I didn't have any A grades, and then I and most a lot of my classmates did. So that was a great thing about Cairn. There's so many smart people went to Cairn School and in my class. So I was surrounded by all of these guys who in the Leaving Cert had multiple A grades. So I was basically in a cycle race. I was in the peloton, being sucked along, And that changed everything with brilliant, some also brilliant teachers. And I mentioned before this, there's so many to mention. PJ McGarry was in biology, Colm Tolan maths and physics. So these guys really inspired me. Des Newton chemistry. So I got A's in all of these subjects, and then that led to getting into medicine.
Yeah, a good story of peer pressure. Not always the type of story that we hear, right?
Yeah.
And was that, did you think you just really hit a sweet spot in a particular school? You know what I mean? Where you had, loads of really quite clever people around you, and then obviously the staff that could maximize that and bring the most out of their students.
No, I think I mean Cairn Dunnet Community School. I thought was a brilliant school, and there was brilliant grades, from some students every year. So there was always a cadre of people in the so-called honors classes, and for physics and maths, the numbers of people doing that were relatively small. Again, not for lack of ability. I think people, didn't want the challenge, but once you reno these guys like McDonald's and from up at Three Trees, and James Keaveney from Mayville, and Michael McDaniel from Cairn Dunnet, who's passed away sadly, and Cathal Doherty, who became a professor of theology, who's brilliant at linguistics. These were the people that I was sitting with, and then I ended up living with in university as well. So the really good having good influences around you is a very useful thing.
It is for sure, but you were from a part of the world whereby, there might have been an expectation to go into the fishing industry, maybe farming industry. Lots of people think emigration is a new thing, but it's not. It's been for generations. Some people come back, some people don't, be it England, Scotland, or further afield. Did you have good family support to sort of pursue what you wanted to do academically, or was it seen as, you need a proper job, or what was that like for you?
So yeah, the big issue, you're absolutely right, Greg, is my parents, my mother, Mary Teresa, who I think's listening or will be listening. Hello, Mum. And my late dad, they were very supportive, but they said, Dennis, we don't have money to send you to college, which is true. But unfortunately, if you disadvantaged and you had good grades, the Donegal County Council helped. And then I had relatives and friends who said they would support me.
Fantastic, they backed you.
So my Aunt Eileen and her husband.
Why, Dennis, if you don't mind me asking, is that so difficult or emotional for you to talk about?
Yeah, it's a good point. It's just that people invest in you. It's a great honor to be supported.
Yeah, they have to believe in you, don't they?
What's that, Greg?
They have to believe in you. But with that comes pressure too, though, to some extent, doesn't it, Dennis?
No, I think when you're in the system and you follow the rules and you work, if you've had the qualifications to get in, then you're going to be fine once you break into the system.
Well, if there was any pressure on you, you excelled in any case, whether there was or not, because you attended the University of College Dublin thanks to those people that believed in you. And it was clear that you were going to do really, really well in medicine.
So no, that's all good. So I remember the first time I went to Dublin. The late John Byrne from Malin, who was a big GAA fan and helped build up Malin GAA, it was actually John who brought me down, and with my uncle Eamon. My father wasn't really a good traveller, but yeah, then John again was so supportive, and I used to work with him in the summers. So yeah, it was a lot of good help, and I got into medicine and went to Dublin and came out with a first class honour in medicine, which was at that stage awarded once every 5 years or so, they told me. So I got a gold medal for that. Then the people of Malin and the late Bertie Boggs, who was a Fine Gael councillor, not that that had anything to do with him organizing this event, but they organized an event in Malin Town in 1990 when I qualified, and many of my old teachers turned up, and That didn't happen for anyone else. The other 100 people had qualified in medicine from the rest of Ireland that year, and many of my classmates were there in awe of the community and camaraderie and great support
Wow,
for the
so
local
even that
people.
early in, your community was so proud of you to give you that kind of a reception home. That's astonishing, isn't it?
But there's been like, around the area, there's been many doctors and PhDs now. I mean, I was, and there were some before me as well, no doubt. Yeah, I was probably the one of the first from Glengad,
So,
at
pardon my
least my area.
ignorance, when you qualify and graduate with a gold medal in medicine in 1990, which is, rare in and of itself, is that in a particular discipline? Is it, what is that setting you up for?
So, just to qualify, at that stage of just once every 5 years, I think it's more often now, because you need to, if you don't award a lot of, if you don't award several first class honours, it looks like people are not very good compared to other universities. So it may have changed. But in the final exams, Greg, there's five things you do: surgery, medicine, psychiatry, obstetrics, gynecology, and I can't remember what the other was. So it was in the specialty of medicine, where I got this award.
Yeah. So is it this now? Are you at a crossroads again? Obviously, you're going to have to forgive my ignorance. Are you at a crossroads where you can sort of perhaps go straight into work, or do you have to pick a discipline and
Oh, yeah,
pursue that
absolutely.
further?
So when you qualify with a basic degree, you have to do 6 months general medicine and 6 months surgery. And then after that, you can decide, do I go medicine, surgery, or something else? So I went for 2 years into my general medical training, and then another year to complete general medical training. And then by mid, so I qualified 1990. Then by 1994, I had to pick that I had general training, which means I could, in theory, go to Letterkenny Hospital and be a consultant on call. So after that, then I had to choose, and all doctors then have to choose what they want to be. So you could become a GP, psychiatry, radiology, obstetrics, gynecology. So within general medicine, I chose to go into rheumatology.
Yes, and you do consultancy work, right? But I mean, we're going to get into the amount of research and understanding that obviously was very important to you. Were you choosing at that point to ensure that you could, obviously work and help people and consult and what have you, but also say, well, can we figure out what's going on here?
My main motivation was I wanted to do something that I found very interesting, and I like the immune system. How we know the immune system in fighting COVID, for example, when it doesn't work well in old people and people die, or in kids where it works too well and they get too much inflammation and they go to ICU and need steroids. So many of the rheumatic diseases are mediated by the immune system. And I decided to do rheumatology because of the balance between seeing patients and medicine and helping people on one hand, but then studying the immune system and tissue repair, which was my area of research interest.
And what I'm just wondering is from when you began in that area and through your research and through other people's research, what year did you start, sorry, particularly working in that space?
Summer 1994, I started in the rheumatology space,
Yeah.
and 18 months in Dublin, and then completed my training in Leeds, the
So I'm
clinical
curious,
training.
between 94 and 2026, between the amazing research you've done and others as well, but you can split that pie as you might, how greater an understanding do we have?
Of arthritis.
Yes, or anything in that space?
It's like everything in science. The rate of knowledge accumulation has been, exponential, like massive. To give you an example, just to put numbers on it, when I started rheumatology, for the rheumatic diseases, we had steroids, anti-inflammatories, gold injections, which could make you shed your skin, which is not good. It's okay if a snake sheds its skin, but if a human sheds their skin, they're dead. It's called an exfoliative dermatitis, if anyone's interested. So these are the sort of side effects we had. So we had very few drugs, and they didn't work particularly well, or they had lots of side effects. Now in 2026, in rheumatology, across the specialty, there's all of these highly specialized drugs. I would say I haven't counted them up recently, but if you looked at all of the diseases with different therapies, there must be at least 30 different drugs, and very effective and very safe, especially if used early. So it's really transformed a lot, Greg. And there's thousands of people working on this area, and most of the key research is done by people in anoraks in labs who never see patients are basically brilliant scientists, and they make discoveries, and then people like myself try and understand where how it works and where it works in humans and how to monitor it and how to optimally use it.
It seems from lots of conversations I have about, various conditions, that some of the worst, or what happens in an awful lot of the cases, it's the body or your body or your immune system becomes your own worst enemy.
Yes.
So what's
Yes.
happening there?
Yeah, so there's many ways that can happen. There's basically two parts of your immune system. There's a part that responds quickly to anything that comes near you. Like if you cut your finger, within minutes, the white cells are coming in, and you can get pus at the site of a thorn, for example, within a day or two. So that's called the innate immune system. It happens very fast, and that can become dysregulated and attack people and cause inflammation. And then the other part of the immune system is called the adaptive immune system, where when your immune system meets a germ, it remembers the germ and it makes multiple antibodies and other things called T cells, which directly kill infected cells. They're like sniper rifles with assassins. They can pick out and take out the infected cell. So when this happens, the immune system remembers the insult. And it's basically on guard for the rest of your life if the threat comes back again. So when people get very old, the immune system can power down, so they can get things like more shingles or TB can reactivate, things that are held in check. So basically, that's the normal side. But unfortunately, in what, up to 3% of the global population, the immune system, for various reason, mistakes self tissue as foreign, and this leads to what's called autoimmunity, where you make antibodies or other mechanisms that attack yourself. So your immune system treats you as an enemy, or it's like friendly fire. So you have a very powerful army, but the friendly fire, when it goes wrong, can kill you.
But often what it seems we have to do, dependent on the condition, is to almost destroy our own defenses, that immune
Yes,
system,
and yes. That's exactly how we treat these conditions. We use drugs that destroy the cells that are attacking us. And historically, that's been cancer drugs, but we in arthritis use cancer drugs at lower doses, because it's not a matter of life and death, unlike cancer. So we can use lower doses to knock things down and usually control disease. So yeah, absolutely. And that's where the problem lies. I have drugs I can give that will wipe out the immune attack and self, called autoimmunity. But if I overdo it, I could we could kill the patient by eliminating their own immune
But we're
system.
doing that
And
really commonly, though, don't we? I mean, I think there's certainly in the northwest of Ireland, I think there is a huge under calculation, or I think it's underestimated how many people are affected with their bowels and their digestive systems, because I encounter far more people than the incident rates would suggest. I wonder, would endometriosis be in that same kind of a space as well, or is that something completely different?
Yeah, well, bowel disease, classically celiac disease, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease are the very inflammatory diseases. And when you have these symptoms, there are other explanations, such as indigestion, or what they call dysbiosis, where there's disharmony with the bugs living in your gut, etc. There's a lot of symptoms, but they're not always autoimmune. So that's a gut side. No, endometriosis is not regarded as an autoimmune disease. The simple explanation for that is the lining of the uterus, which is shed once a month during menses or menstruation or periods. Unfortunately, some of the lining, rather than going out, gets back up into the abdominal cavity, and then it takes up residence there, and then it can't be shed monthly, so it leads to this painful condition. So there is immune activity in endometriosis, but it's regarded as secondary to the damage rather than primary.
In your research, or perhaps maybe it's broader than it is specific, what nut are you really trying to crack, but you are chipping away from the shell, but we're just not quite through yet? What will be the significant breakthrough in this area, do you feel?
Yeah, so first of all, the lay people get the idea that there's massive, big momentous discoveries that change everything. But the reality is, most of what happens now is incremental or small changes. There's rarely like a massive breakthrough. But the area I've spent a long time on is looking at adult stem cells to try and improve wear and tear. And there are many groups around the world looking at this. I've been looking at it for 30 years, and there's people looking at it for 30 years, the year I was born, looking at this. And basically, there's no effective regeneration for this wear and tear or osteoarthritis, which is a very common condition. It's the most common rheumatic disease. So I've been doing that in the background, but it's very hard to get money to study this because we're so unsuccessful. But where the autoimmune diseases are concerned, we've been very successful in getting grants here in Leeds.
Just focusing
And
on osteoarthritis for a moment. You talk about difficulty in getting funding and all that kind of stuff, and come down this rabbit hole for me for a moment. But there just seems to be the potentially so much money actually in people aging and their joints wearing down, and it's almost like a self-feeding industry. Even if you actually make, the hips or the knee joints or whatever it might be from that, there isn't pushback, is there? On against people like you who are looking to try and almost eliminate something, right? But there's another group of people that would have to find different things to do if you were successful. Am I mad?
No, I think it's true to say if a surgeon in private practice replaces a knee joint, they get a very healthy fee. Whereas if they're to do something less invasive that doesn't require a lot of skill or a drug that worked, there's no incentive to do that. But however, the reality is, Greg, there is lots of good trials done, and basically an injection of cortisone into a painful knee, which has been around since the 50s, nothing has topped that yet, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. And
So that's what happened.
you talked about, people working on something for 30 years, and then you're working on something for 30 years, and then people hopefully, if well, not hopefully, hopefully you get it sorted, but if they don't, we'll follow you. Is there a connectivity between that work? Obviously, you do your own research, right? But is there a
Yeah.
bit of baton handing going on here as
Yeah,
well?
absolutely. Yeah, there's, for example, arthritis of the knee is strongly linked to obesity or weight, and the arthritis typically occurs in the same place on the inside of the knee, and most people who get it, and companies are looking at trying to build the cartilage, which is the shock absorber at that site. So yeah, absolutely, everything we do is based on prior expertise and knowledge. And when you write a paper, the most important thing to do is to cite previous literature that supports your logic and way of thinking in what you do. So yeah, we absolutely do build on things, but there's this term in medicine and technology and science called disruptive technology. So sometimes people throw the rule book out and they start from scratch and they come up with a radical new solution, but that rarely happens. And I wish it would happen in osteoarthritis, but I don't think it will.
Is there anything that you see us doing now that what might actually exacerbate issues, you know, with wear and tear into the future? I remember asking someone, I always thought, I'm not discouraging anyone, but, you know, when I'm in bed at like 5 o'clock, there's other people coming up, getting up, and they're pounding on concrete, running, or they're swinging these massive bells around their head. And I remember saying to this fellow professional of yours, surely that can't be good for you. And he says, no, the benefits outweigh any risks. But what's your view in relation to all of that?
Yeah, broadly speaking, I agree with that person. So, Greg, the thing is, if you take marathon runners who are pounding the roads, 26 miles and lots of training, there isn't much evidence to say they get more arthritis, right, or wear and tear. There's more evidence that, you know, if you have a trauma to your knee, so like coming in contact with somebody like Roy Keane in a bad mood, injuries to joints, like, you know, a knock or a break or a severe injury, that certainly predisposes to wear and tear at a later stage. Obesity, being overweight, also predisposes to low back and knee osteoarthritis, but interestingly not ankle wear and tear, even though the ankle's taking extra weight compared to the knee. So basically, avoiding major injuries. I think lifting very heavy bells could certainly cause damage to the wear and tear in the shoulder, for sure. I'd say keeping fit and active is good. Avoid injuries or things that are too heavy, and keeping the weight down is a good idea.
And I'm not for a moment contradicting you, but there seems to be an extremely high rate of knee and hip injury in, say, for instance, GAA footballers, you know, late 30s, 40s, 50s. Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you. Is that likely the rough and tumble of the game rather than if they were running without interference?
Yeah, that's a good point. Partly, yeah. The other thing is, obviously, these guys are running fast, and then they unnaturally change direction, you know, and go these twisting movements, and damage the discs in the knee called the menisci, which then rip and tear. So, yeah, these contact sports and rapid changes of direction seem to be more likely than doing a repetitive low impact movement.
Completely different before we move on, but I used to suffer quite a bit with gout, which is a form of arthritis, is it? Strictly speaking.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, it's very interesting. Gout, what happens is when the DNA from your cells has been broken down, it's broken down into this chemical called uric acid. Mm. And if your kidneys are not pumping it out properly, it accumulates in the colder part of your body. So it's like if you put hot salt in a glass and stir it up in hot water, you don't see the salt, but when the temperature settles down, the salt comes out, and the gout salts come out in the cold extremities, and you will know the big toe and ankle region. So the crystals come out there, and then the crystals have sharp edges, and they damage the white cells, which are the ones that fight infection, and the white cells become angry. And then you get this inflammation.
Yes, what I've always found, and my kind of motivation for asking the question, and thankfully it's not something I suffer with currently, but if I got a knock or something, you know, almost, you know, within hours, it was almost as if these nasty, sharp things would head to that particular area. And also, I was curious, why would, say, if you knocked your ankle or your big toe or your wrist, will all of a sudden you start getting this gout-related pain?
Yeah, it's a great question. The reason that happens, Greg, is the crystals or salts are deposited there, and they're already in the tissue, but they're encapsulated to try and keep them quiet. So when you injure it, you rip the tissue microstructure, and then they get out, and the white cells kick off. So this is well recognized. So an injury is a big trigger of gout, yeah.
You mentioned stem cell research a little bit earlier on. This is an area of medicine that you've obviously seen enough that frustrates you, and that obviously there's been some huge advances. And I'm not saying you're saying some of it's snake oil or what have you, but what is it particularly about that space that you want to see good guide rails on?
Yeah, so historically, Greg, stem cells have transformed medicine. And that's the blood stem cell. So if somebody has a leukemia or a cancer, you will hear them having a stem cell transplant. So the stem cell they're getting is a stem cell that lives in the bone marrow or resides in the bone marrow, and it makes blood so you can breathe and oxygen, and it makes white cells so you have an immune system. So that type of stem cell is being used in medicine for nearly, for 60 years to help treat leukemia and various cancers and other things. But the stem cells in the joint are a different beast entirely, and they're more localized to the joint. And the problem you have, Greg, is when you do a blood stem cell transplant, you put the cells into the blood and they find their way back to the bone marrow, which is normal. But if you have somebody with bone on bone, with arthritis, then putting stem cells into that space is like putting them between two millstones. So they get pulverized or crushed. So this is
Now,
the
would that
big
offer any
problem.
temporary relief, or is it
No,
so it's pointless?
evidence. No evidence, Greg.
We
So,
see, we see people offering, we see people, particularly in the private space, if not exclusively, offering stem cell type of treatment for, say, for instance, bad knees and what have you. That clearly then is of great concern to you.
Okay, so just to say, in young athletes or footballers, they often have just a piece of cartilage or the shock absorber gouged out from their knee. But around that, there's normal tissue. So putting stem cells, say in a professional athlete, into a defect in somebody under 30 is beneficial.
But standard
But
wear and tear, what about that?
But in the older population with wear and tear, the damage is very diffuse. There's often bone on bone, and there's lots of calls for regulation of this. There's a private cottage industry around the world in many countries offering all sorts of stem cell treatments, including bone marrow injection. Sometimes, Greg, they take the fat from the tummy wall. And then they pop the fat cells, and then there's stem cells in the tissues, and then they inject those into the joint cavity. They also use stem cells from umbilical cord. So after the baby's born, the cord's cut and thrown away. But if you send that cord to the lab, you can extract lots of stem cells, which are foreign to somebody else. But these stem cells don't trigger a rejection reaction. And they can be injected into knees. But all of those things I've just described, when they're properly assessed in clinical trials, when the doctors are giving different treatments, and then the patients are evaluated at 6 months to see are they any better, there hasn't been one iota of good evidence in the older age group who get osteoarthritis.
Now, I think the
So
worst thing, I think the worst thing than hope is false hope.
Yeah, well, patients come to me asking me about stem cell therapy, and they say they're going to a private clinic and pay £25,000 for it. And I say, well, if you've got that money to spare, can you give it to my research fund and you'll be as far on? And nobody takes me up on that offer.
It's hard to keep track of your. That's because they can't see the vision. It's hard to keep track of your accolades. Some of the international awards include Germany's Carol Nachmann Award for outstanding contributions to rheumatology, the Pemberton Prize in the United States, and honors from the Royal Academy of Medicine in Ireland. And we're speaking to you in the context of your receiving the prestigious Hibernian Medal by the British Society of Rheumatology. You're the only, second only Irish person. You know that. I'm just saying this for our listeners, and the very first from the 26 counties, if we want to break it down. So, what does it? How important are these things to you, Dennis?
Yeah, Greg. Well, yeah, it was founded in 1938 after a guy who described wear and tear, actually. William Heberden was his name, a British, a physician with an interest in arthritis. This was before there was rheumatologists. So they founded this award nearly 100 years ago. And once every year at the highlight of the Congress, they award a medal to somebody for, a contribution. And some of the people that have won that award have been Nobel Prize winners, and people have discovered like new drugs for arthritis. So there's some. I'm not in the same league as these guys, but the
Well,
point is, I'm recording the
that's
same
by your
patterns.
reckoning. Obviously, your peers believe you are.
But yeah, it's a great honor. It recognizes a lifetime of hard work. And Greg, the thing about research is, being able to do research is the absolute pinnacle of a complex society who is able to invest taxpayers' money in guys to sit around thinking and trying to improve the situation. And then you need everything going well, because you can't do research and think if you have a if your life's in tatters elsewhere. So you need a good strong family and support around you. So I have Annette and the boys over here in Leeds, and a big network of scientists I've worked with. So it's like a GAA captain going up to lift the trophy on behalf of a very large team. So it's a real team effort, and that's the great thing about it is the recognition of all of these brilliant people that we've been
Yes,
lucky enough.
and that's in the space of research, but obviously you also combine that work with consultancy work with the NHS. Is that by accident and design? How or design, sorry, how important do you think it is to keep your head in the game, to keep your finger on the pulse by actually also seeing, real world cases and then being able to maybe marry or use that knowledge in the research sphere?
Absolutely, Greg. So that's what they call like a clinical academic. So that's a big thing in the UK and Ireland. So you're a medical. So you get paid a few days a week by the NHS or the HSE in Ireland, and then the other 3 days a week or more, you then do research. So yeah, you see and learn a lot from patients, and it's vital to have doctors that straddle that gap. Some doctors who do 10 clinics a week are much better physicians and diagnostic experts than I would be, because they're so more practiced. A full-time laboratory scientist like Luke O'Neill in Trinity College, everyone will have heard of Luke. He's a brilliant scientist and orator and writer even. But there's these two extremes, and you need these guys in the middle. I liken it to a scrum half in rugby. You need that guy that is in there at one end and spinning it out to the scientists or back and forward. So that's a very unique role, and it's a great honor to be in this position where the patients and knowledge and how they respond to drugs as well, Greg, informs you about disease. So yeah, it's a well-tested model around the world.
Imagine with me that your career is a status bar, and zero was, walking into sort of national school in Malin many years ago. And 100 is where, or what you believe you realistically can achieve through your research work. I'm trying to figure out where this status bar is on 0
Yeah,
to
yeah, yeah,
100.
yeah, yeah, yeah. I would put it at about 60 out of 100.
That's ambitious, isn't it? Or
No, well, I mean, 100 out of 100 being like,
just where you believe that you can take your research, you know?
well, no, well, my ambition when I started would have been 100 out of 100. And what I'm saying is I'd say reached 50, 60
I
maximum.
get you, yeah.
And the reason I say that, when I started research, there were other people in many other areas in the immune system, doing things that I thought this doesn't seem very good to me. And then these guys, not people I know personally, but these guys then won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for transformative understanding of the immune system. For example, people with various cancers now can get drugs to stimulate the immune system to kill the cancer. I'm doing the opposite. I'm giving drugs to suppress the immune system to stop it attacking self. But you see, the point I'm making is If I was 30 years back, I took the wrong fork in the road.
I get you.
So you see what I mean?
How is, if at all, AI assisting you in, I mean, not necessarily coming up with answers, though you can explain that, but maybe doing some of the heavy lifting or the laborious work that maybe someone of your intellect doesn't need to be doing?
Yeah, so this is a very good question. So first of all, I use ChatGPT, but only to just get a quick verification of what I was thinking is on the right track, and I haven't missed anything. The medical fraternity and the medical journals are very against the use of AI to assist us on doing things. It's a major issue. There's lots of claims how it's going to transform medicine. It's useful for interpreting scans like MRI scans of the brain or CT scans of the chest, but it's full place in the research space is still to be
And
defined.
is that because they're, are we sure that that's, that people aren't sort of saying that out of an abundance of caution, or do people perhaps maybe feel a little bit threatened by it and want to keep it at arm's length? I wonder what the mix is of that.
I think this. I think all of those are applied to different people. But for example, people are using AI to design new drugs from scratch, and they're being
Well, we've
tested
just
and.
seen, I think, our first drug completely created by AI. So there you have a vaccine, sorry, I believe it was.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, but that's an example of the creativity. But yeah, it's a very good. We have to wait and see where it will land. The one thing I would say is in the area where I'm an expert, or I think I'm an expert, and then I ask a difficult question to AI, it gives me a very woolly answer.
Yeah.
So I think it's okay if you're asking, what time is the next bus or what time is the next flight, etc. It's great for that information. But when it comes to critical evaluation and thinking and strategy, I still think we need humans. But this is a yeah. It's I'm basically like yourself. I'm watching this space. It hasn't had a huge impact on how I work, but maybe that's because I'm too old and a
No,
human
I
to
don't
change.
think it's that. I think the way you've described it, I mean, we have yet to see the sort of true learning models and all that type of stuff. And a lot of it really is it just search the internet and output stuff out. But listen, the future might be very exciting. Finally, an intro. Actually, can I just pause this for one moment? Because there's a bell ringing here in the background. And there's an interesting connection to the wild alpaca way. Well, a strong connection, isn't there, Adonis? But an interesting connection maybe with alpacas and your chosen area of study.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I'm working with industry on antibodies derived from camelids, which include camels, alpacas, and llamas. And the antibodies these animals make are much, much smaller than human antibodies, so they're very easy to work with, and they penetrate the tissues better because they're smaller. And yeah, I'm involved in research with industry trying to understand a new one of these antibodies that's going to be coming to treat a condition called psoriatic arthritis in the next few years. So, yeah, I say to my brother John in Wild Alpaca Way that those alpacas, you could take blood from them and make new treatments for arthritis. So, yeah, so this is one of many strategies to make new drugs. Yeah.
You've made and spent much of your life in Britain, in Leeds. You talked of the family that are there with you, incredibly important to you.
Yes.
Your mother, Mary Teresa, though, remains incredibly important to you and with us, which is fantastic. Also keeping you grounded, I am sure. But it allows you ample opportunity to come back home. Donegal's still very much part of you and who you are.
Absolutely. I've been over, I think, three, four times this year, and I'll be coming over now, in the next few weeks as she gets older and she needs to see us more. But yeah, it's a great place, Greg. Yeah, I love going there.
Lovely stuff. And just finally, what is your greatest motivation now, or your goal, or, you know, what you want to do or would love to do? I mean, are you in a space where you could have a breakthrough where everything changes all of a sudden, or is it a patient chipping away at the issue?
Yeah, so Greg, the way I'd put it is in the 1920s, they discovered insulin. So they can't cure diabetes, but you can give people a normal life expectancy with insulin. And it's the same with many of these rheumatic diseases. We can't cure them, but we can give people a normal life expectancy. So increasingly, we're thinking of what if you could cure disease? And we and others are working on, you know, novel strategies, like magic bullets, they call them, to try and kill all of the bad cells and leave the good ones alone. So that's my main motivation, is to, so I work with, you know, industry and companies and, you know, molecular biologists, people that, you know, engineer drugs from scratch. So that, yeah, that would be the big motivation to keep going. And of course, applying the stem cells and wear and tear is also a motivation. But as I say, it is incremental. It's not like the discovery of penicillin, you know, where overnight the world's going to change. So yeah, motivation is obviously key. And that's also driven by all these excellent young people I work with.
Finally, if you were to give advice to people out there, maybe even younger people that might be listening to us, those in their 20s or 30s, and I talk to them particularly because, you know, there is a time in life, if you're blessed with good health, that you feel that you're bulletproof and that will be there forever. But you are seeing on a daily basis, you know, people with all different health levels, but still age-related wear and tear. What advice would you give to people to best, as it stands now, maintain their skeletal structure and their joints and what have you?
Yeah, so you know, to they call it healthy aging now, right? So to get to, you know, to try and get to 80, obviously there's no golden, you know, there's no easy solution. Keep fit and active, keep your weight down, don't drink too much, don't smoke, avoid injuries. And yeah, obviously avoid stress, but who can avoid stress? So and the other thing, Greg, is unfortunately my friend in college, Dr. Dennis Kelly, his father died when he was 45. Dennis is now 60 like me, but when we met each other in college, he said, you can't be too careful when you choose your parents. So genetics is also very important.
Yeah, it is. And that's always something that's come up when we've discussed on the program the issue of adoption and what have you, and the records of adoption, how we deal with that. Because so often, and I've noticed myself, particularly as I get older, so much weight is placed on you know, the hereditary nature of certain conditions and what have you. So it is so, so important. Absolutely. Right. Thank you so very much for your time. Congratulations on all you have achieved and continue to achieve. And we will continue to watch on your career with interest, because it's a fascinating area of work. And we just really want to thank you for joining us for this episode.
Well, thanks so much, Greg, for asking. It's great to speak to the people at Donegal. And sorry, I couldn't mention more people, which may land me in trouble.
I was wondering, should you have bothered mentioning anyone at all? I was thinking that a little earlier on. But anyway, listen, it'll be a good opportunity to talk to people and explain why you didn't mention them.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks once again to Dennis, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode as much as I did. And don't forget, there's a full back catalogue of episodes with amazing guests. You can catch up on our website, highlandradio.com, or search the Greg Hughes podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you did enjoy it, please tell a friend. And don't forget to like and subscribe, and maybe even leave a review. Right, we'll be back with another episode next Friday at 11 a.m. Don't forget, if you have any feedback in relation to the podcast, you can contact its researcher and producer, Caroline Orr, at carolineorr@highlandradio.com. But we'll chat to you again real soon.